Welcome to the first ever Blue Moon Fest at the Mac. It was just a short 2 months ago, I think, that we came up with this idea. We thought we want to throw a party where we can invite a few hundred of our closest friends, drink beer, have a good time, listen to some great bands, and not have the cops shut us down because it's too noisy at 10 o'clock at night. Where can you do that but at the Mac? So we're very lucky to be here. A special thank you to the Village of McCook, Mayor Chabowski right there. Thank you, Jeffrey, for letting us do this tonight. I got to thank a couple people. Wouldn't be anything without our friends. And Anheuser-Busch over there, Budweiser people with the Stella. Thank you so much for helping us out tonight. And it would definitely not be anything without our friends from Miller Coors, who are here with some amazing beers tonight. Also, thank you so much for your help. I want to definitely recognize Finch's Beer, a new brew company here in Chicagoland area. Those guys stepped up really big to help us tonight. I appreciate it. AIS Computer Services in Countryside, Vulcan Materials, Samuel Adams Beer, Floyd's Barbershop, and new Chicago Beer Company. And obviously they're located here in downtown Chicago. We also want to thank Freeborn and Peters. Getting all the announcements out of the way. I do want to tell you about quickly the 5th annual School Rocks, a fundraiser for San Miguel Schools. They're here tonight selling tickets. You also have a chance to win 2 tickets to this event. It's Thursday, October 20th. And the only guy that can throw a party better than I can is my friend Kevin Elodi. Of course, he had to go and rent the House of Blues and invite Cheap Trick to do it. But that is going to be a great event. So if you can make it to see Cheap Trick at the House of Blues, support inner city students, that would be awesome. It is Thursday, October 20th. See the people from San Miguel Schools for more info in the back over there. And tonight, our beneficiary from this event is Betty's Love Alzheimer's Charities. Maureen Gavin is here tonight. Maureen is the best. She's selling her own raffle tickets. She's selling auction items. And I know there's a fabulous fat tire bike back there somebody can win tonight and take home with them also. Alzheimer's awareness and the things that Betty does in our area is amazing. She is a small charity. You might not have heard about her until tonight, but you're going to hear a lot about her coming up in the future. So thank you for supporting Betty's Love Alzheimer's Charities. I want to thank a few other people. I want to thank Charlene Vickery, who co-hosted, co-sponsored, and helped me out with this. I want to thank Marcy and Jen from Great Events for all your great work. Thank you so much. I want to thank all of you for coming. I want to thank all of you for supporting great beer. We have fabulous beer guys over there. You guys are awesome. Thank you for being here and helping us out our first year. Hopefully, if you like this tonight, let us know. Let the mayor know. We might get to make this an annual event. Last but not least, from the Palmer family, I want to thank you all for being here, supporting us, supporting our community, supporting our other food vendors that are here from Chase Root Beer Company, Home Run Inn, and the Cupcake Ladies with some great cupcakes over there. Thank you again for being here, supporting us. We appreciate it. And now, if the boys are ready, ladies and gentlemen, this band is not only a main stage number one band out there, they are booked double tonight, and they are going to another show after this show and performing again at midnight. These guys are the hottest thing out there. They are great. First time in our area, I believe. They didn't know where McCook was until I showed them how to get here on the map. Ladies and gentlemen, Seventh Heaven. Thank you.
Hi, folks. This is Bobby Mackey of Bobby Mackey's Music World in Wilder, Kentucky, and you're listening to Dominion Live Radio.
Welcome to Radio Free America. America's ready. I'm ready. I mean, I want a million voices crying out in the wilderness. Let's get serious.
Never give up.
Never surrender.
Oh, yes, we can. And yes, we will.
One man don't make a difference, think again. Cause I just started an army picking up a pen. This begins a global collaboration to take the whole world and make the one nation. This ain't no imitation, what you're hearing is elite. That's why everything shocks when you hear us speak. Oh, back to the mission at hand, we got a plan. Take the message that we're sending and spread it across the land. It's in black and white, it's been written, been red. Now let every single syllable settle into your head. As it slowly resonates from your mind to your feet, we'll make the earthquake. Off of this beat. Cause if you're hearing this right now, the battle's been won. It's spreading, my friend. The takeover has begun. This is our world, our streets, our war, our lives. This is what we fight for. Our choice to make the wrong things right with our voice. We bring day to the night. This is our world, our streets, our war, our lives. This is what we fight for. Our choice. We're the voice of the globe. Turn up the volume so everybody knows. This is our world, our streets, our war. This is our world, our streets, our war, our lives. This is what we fight for, our choice. We're the voice of the globe. Turn up the volume so everybody knows. This is our world, our streets, our war, our lives. This is what we fight for, our choice. To make the wrong things right with our voice. We bring day to the night. This is our world, our streets, our war, our lives. This is what we fight for, our choice. We're the voice of the globe.
Welcome. The Halloween edition of Dominion Live Radio, the Jabberjaw Show for the, the 28th of October, 31 days of Halloween. This is music from Nitgrit called Invisible Monster, right here on Dominion Live. On tonight's broadcast, we're joined by Ryan Katzenbach, and we're going to find out where what's going on with. I have a request out there to get Geraldine and John Hyback on the program. We'll find out. Ryan will be up momentarily. Hang in there. Also tonight I have more music from the Shattered Hopes movie. I'll be featuring some of that. It's all coming up, so stay tuned in. Streaming it. If you're having problems with the stream tonight, if it sounds kind of muddy, it'll be all right. It's recording. Everything's recording fine. And you'll be able, if you're having difficulty, the podcast will be fine. Just continue streaming it. Now, this is from the Shattered Hopes movie. I don't know specifically the... This is very... It's labeled intense. Oh. I'm running. I'm being chased right now. Ugh. Oh, they're gonna catch me! Ah! That was beautiful. Alright, we have another piece here. Let's try this out. Intense. We got the intention. How about this one? Secret trailer. Where did they go? Oh, secret trailer piece. Let's try this.
Creepy.
Once upon a time, in a little house on Halloween night, next time on 60 Minutes. The music I can't get out of my head. The stuff we had last time I had Ryan on. Oh, Jesus. I wasn't expecting that. Oh, my God. Scared the crap out of me. Jesus. All right. Music pieces there from the upcoming Shattered Hopes movie. And Halloween is this Monday night. Of course, it's the annual Halloween show, previously mentioned. What are you guys doing for Halloween? I saw Paranormal Activity 3 today, and I have to say, it's paranormally better than the first two. At least I saw it, though. You throw some kids in there, a couple creepy kids, and, you know, stuff flying around the house, bada-bing, bada-boom, you got yourself a really scary movie. Hey, it's creepy kids. That's always going to, you're going to connect with your own childhood here and there, and things that scared you when you were a kid. Good thinking to the director and the producers of that film. Unlike the other two, this one, the end piece, the 15-minute end piece, everyone says that the end piece is, well worth the ticket. Okay, it sure is, but the rest of the movie's good, too. Just as much scared. The scene with the sheet and the babysitter in the sheet. Whoa. Wow. So we're just waiting for Ryan's call. A lot of parties going on this weekend, obviously. Some parties going on in some graveyards, which I personally don't approve of. What are you going to have a party in a graveyard for? Of course, the movie The Thing, that is out. You can go see that. That's out at your local theaters. And I'm waiting for the movie Munger Road to come to my theater. And it's yet to come to my theater. I got it in some of the suburbs out here, but anyone seen this movie? Let me know. Let me know how good it is. This phone is plugged in, right? Yeah, I know I checked it. Everything is... Let me... hold on. What did I do with my cell phone? One second. We gotta... I know I tested the phone earlier, but it's got a bad feeling here. Something ain't right. Hold on. Of course, he calls when I get up from the chair. Ryan, how are you?
I am well, Brian. How are you? And happy Halloween.
Oh, happy Halloween to you. You as well.
You know, this number works very well when I don't transpose the numbers.
Oh.
And I'm actually able to, I just shot you a message, so disregard, obviously.
Oh, okay. I was thinking, he probably has a problem with, oh, I see it coming up on the Facebook there. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all right. That's cool.
Awesome. So how's your Halloween going so far?
Oh, it's going great. It's tradition to have you on every year.
Well, it's become a tradition because it's taken so long. This film has become so epic in its making that who would have thought that it would have taken 2 or 3 years, you know, since we started talking and since we started doing these shows before it would be complete.
Oh, well, you know, I have a couple questions here for you.
shoot.
Okay, the first question is, was Geraldine and John, are they out trick-or-treating together? Is that why I can't get them on my show?
With John's schedule, he works a lot, and it's very hard to pin him down. I know when we were shooting the film, you know, it usually took 2 or 3 weeks, before a shoot to get everything lined up. And so when you do something with John, you typically have to plan just because of how busy he is. So what we need to do if you want to get him on is we need to set a date, and we need to set a date 2, 3, 4 weeks out in advance and just put it on the calendar and get it locked down. It's you know, when you have working actors, a lot of times they'll get a call, you know, 2 days or 2 hours sometimes before a shoot and say, you know, we need you here. Plus, he has a regular, you know, just a regular job like so many of us in the industry, you know, that pays the bills. And as for Geraldine, yeah, I think she's probably out trick-or-treating right now.
I just picture the two of them out together. John is in character as Ronald DeFeo Jr., and they're, you know, scaring everybody. Boo!
That would be a pretty scary duo, actually.
Trick or treat.
Yeah. Well, Jerry, you know, I know that you've asked me a couple of times about Jerry coming on the show, and Jerry's position on it is, and we just had this discussion probably last week sometime. And, you know, I had asked her, I said, did you ever give it any thought? Because you have to understand, I won't tell her. You know, if somebody asks for an interview, I will pass it along to her. I will not say, you know, you can't do it, don't do it, whatever. It's her call. I mean, this is, in a lot of ways, her story. It's up to her who she wants to talk to. And, you know, her reply to me was, you've already got my story. My story is already, you know, on the record, and you know, let the film come out and let the film be my voice, you know. And she says, as she said to me, she says, I have nothing further to say about this. Everything that I had to say is in the film, and I'm done with this. And, you know, Jerry, she has, you know, a lot of things going on in her life. You know, she has her own, you know, her own kids, and then she has grandkids, and she has a great granddaughter now that takes up a lot of her time. So, you know, this is a woman who has really moved on from this tragedy, and a lot of ways, I think, has kind of come to peace with it and kind of come to terms with it. And I think that I think that doing this has probably helped her with that quite a bit, you know. and so her official comment to pass on to you was, you know, after the film, there may be a different story. If there's something that's specific that's on the table that you want to talk about, or there's specific questions that the film didn't answer in some way, you know, as she said, you know, I might be willing to entertain it at that point. So it's kind of an open-ended thing at this point.
Okay. Fair enough. So any, being that it's Halloween, you got any spooky stories from the set?
I think that our editing system is plagued with demonic forces, I think. We've had a rough run of luck the last couple of weeks with editing, with computers misbehaving and doing whatever they want to do, and I've been out all day today trying to take care of an issue with some memory on a computer. I think I got a RAM bank that went bad on our main editing system. And, you know, other than that, we blew an entire set of studio monitors up a couple weeks ago and spent $1,000 fixing that problem. And, you know, just par for the course stuff. And of course, we're moving expeditiously towards the release date of the film. And we're pretty excited about that. There's a lot going on right now. We've been wading through. I think you've probably seen on Facebook as well as on our YouTube channel, we've started a new campaign that's been dubbed Revealed. And each one of the teasers that we're going to present is going to tell a unique little fact about the DeFeos, about the case, by those who were actually there. And those teasers, I believe we've got about a dozen of them in the hopper right now. And those have started running. The first one debuted on Tuesday. It was supposed to debut last Friday, but then I ended up being gone. And the new one, a brand new one, another 45-second teaser, debuted this afternoon, or I guess early evening, technically. And we're going to be dropping those teasers from here on out, basically every Friday. And as we get closer to the release date, we're probably going to increase the frequency of that.
Do we have an official release date?
We do.
Oh, my
God. We do, in fact.
All right.
official release for part one of the film is going to be December 16th, 2011.
Okay, that'd be a nice stocking stuffer for some people.
It could very well be that the product will actually, the DVD will actually begin shipping on that date, and pre-ordering will kick off right around Black Friday, the 25th of November, And there should be on Thanksgiving Day, I don't want to spoil anything or whatever, but on Thanksgiving Day, there's going to be a pretty cool trailer that's going to come out for part one that will kind of kick off the pre-ordering of the DVDs.
Thanksgiving Day at the DeFeo House.
Thanksgiving Day. Thanksgiving Day. A huge holiday at the DeFeo home. I think, as you recall from part one of the film, the last Thanksgiving planned at the DeFeo House was to be a rather special one, if you remember.
Oh, yes. Oh, my. Yeah. You know, I forgot about that. Can I say no?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, Jerry's recollection that Louise had told her, whether it was, you know, serious or whether it was in jest, you know, that she was planning on killing them all with poison at their last Thanksgiving dinner. Now, you know, I think that we know from the various documents that we have and from emails that Lynn Nonowitz sent to Rick Osuna while Rick was writing the book. There was a lot going on in that house at that moment, and I think that, you know, kind of as Geraldine points out in the film, you know, that I think Louise was reaching her breaking point. And I think there's a lot of other things said in the film that indicate that Louise was really getting to the point where she couldn't take anymore, you know. So whether, and then you've got, of course, Lynn's email is very eerie when you read it, you know, when she says that Louise had stated to her that there is going to be a tragedy, okay, and everybody is going to think that this is a horrible tragedy, but in reality it will be a blessing in disguise. And Lynn's email goes on to say that blessing, that sacred thing that was going to happen, was that no one ever again would have to live with Big Ronnie DeFeo. You know, so if Louise was telling the housekeeper and making statements like that to the housekeeper, it's kind of a pretty good indicator that there were a lot of problems in that house, that this was not a nice place to live.
No. Was that the scene with the napkin dropping and then Arnold Sr., jumping. Was that a Thanksgiving moment? Was that one of the Thanksgiving moments from a previous?
You know, it's I would say no. It was more of just a routine nightly kind of thing. You know, that is a story that, of course, is in The Knights of the DeFeos Died,
yeah.
Wherein, you know, Jerry recounted that Butch had, you know, dropped a napkin, and he scooted his chair out to pick it up from the floor, and when he picked it up, you know, Big Ronnie says to him, you know, in this house, you excuse yourself when you leave the table. And Butch simply replies to his father, I didn't leave the table. I wasn't excusing myself. I was simply picking up a napkin, at which point Big Ronnie goes into this tirade and beats the hell out of Butch, you know. And there are so many moments, as you saw in part one, that you can't really pinpoint an exact date. You can't really pinpoint when this took place because, you know, according to a lot of the accounts I've got, the insanity was ongoing all the time. So to say this was March 14th, 1973 at 7 p.m., who knows? It's anybody's guess. But we're just kind of, throughout the film, we're just kind of taking a snapshot, you know, at various intervals of the things that are said to have gone on.
So what, I noticed on your Facebook, I saw a video of, I think it was you. You were doing some scuba diving in the Amityville Canal. Dun, 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 dun.
Well, I wasn't doing the scuba diving.
Oh, okay.
I have a team that was doing a little bit of diving work for me, and I somehow figured you were going to ask some questions about this, and I'll answer as much as I can, but there's some things pending for part three of the film that we're working on that deals specifically with the forensics of the case, and that is specifically what we're doing with the divers right now pertains to the forensics, and we're taking a good hard look at something that I think needs to have a good hard look taken at it, if that makes sense.
Did you, I don't know if you can answer this, but did you find anything?
Well, I can't, I'm not going to answer. Understand, there's some agreements that I've made with some different parties and some different agencies that we have to kind of keep the findings of what's out there relegated to the film when the film comes out. And that's something, I mean, I can give you the background on what we're doing, and I can tell you a little bit about why we're doing this and what has transpired, if you would like to hear that.
Sure, but I also think, I think I know what you found. I think you found a carcass of Jody the Pig.
Oh, well, we actually just decided to leave that on the bottom.
Okay. Well, okay. Well, so, what is the process of what it is you're going around? Because the video was a bit of a teaser. I was thinking the guy said he found gold or something. I don't know.
Well, here's what happened. Okay, as I've told you in the past, and I think we actually talked about this on the show. You know, we uncovered a number of documents that I had never seen before, and I don't know if anybody's ever seen them before. And I honestly don't believe at law that we are probably entitled to those documents, because those documents contain a lot of handwritten notes, a lot of work product, a lot of stuff that probably by law shouldn't probably be in our hands, but it's too late now, and we've already got it. And one of the things that I found was I found some reports and some paperwork pertaining directly to the ballistics associated with the case. And the one thing that we discovered was that, you know, for a long time, and Brian, I can't remember, you read Rick Osuna's book, right?
Oh, years ago, yeah.
Right. And you know that Rick was like really one of the first people to make the revelation or to state that it was his thesis that there was a second bullet removed from Louise DeFeo.
Okay.
And I believe
yeah.
it was item number 33.
Right.
And he had some documentation that kind of shored that up. But we've got some documentation that I think proves it.
Okay.
And what it proves is that seven of the bullets from the Marlin rifle matched, okay, and the eighth one does not. Now, in a gun, and I don't want to get too crazy specific here with anything, but I think you understand that every time a bullet is fired from a gun, there is a mark, there is marking left on the bullet that is referred to as rifling. Okay, and if you understand anything about rifling, usually the rifling kind of twists down the barrel, and what it does is it causes the bullet, the projectile, to spin when it leaves the barrel of the gun, which adds to the stability and overall the velocity of the bullet. Okay, so every bullet fired from a gun has got essentially under a microscope a signature on it, you know, that they can, and I don't know if you're a CSI fan or whatever, you know, which I always laugh at that show because it kind of oversimplifies things. But when they put them under microscope, what they typically do is they'll fire a bullet from the gun, and then they'll compare it to the ones removed from the victims. In this particular case, seven of the shells match up. The rifling is the same, and they're able to specifically identify that seven of the bullets had 12 lands and grooves, which are characteristics, okay, of the Marlin rifle, okay? But there's an eighth bullet, an odd duck out, that has a completely different diameter, that has a completely different grain weight, and it has eight lands and grooves. And eight lands and grooves is consistent with a 38 millimeter, or a 38 caliber, what I believe to be a handgun, okay? And so we read this material, and I processed this documentation, and of course this is in complete support of what Rick Osuna said in 2001 when he published his book. And but then there became some questions because of some of the statements. You know, I think if you recall, Rick's book states that Bobby Kelski disposed of his handgun that was used in the commission of the crime, which is supposedly this .38, you know, in the smudge pot at Briganti Carl Buick. But there's some other evidence that surfaced and some other statements and some other things that could suggest that this didn't happen, that the gun never made it to Briganti Carl Buick, and that the gun was tossed in a waterway, which leads to what we're doing. And what we're doing is when we first put this all together and it suddenly hit me, I'm realizing, wait a minute, I think I know the significance of a couple of these crime scene photos. I think I know what I'm looking at, which then once the possibility was raised and I felt like this needs to be looked at, you know, we had to do it. You know, we had to do it. I didn't want to leave this on the table. So this was in the early part of the year. This was like in February of the year, of this year. And, you know, Gail Bleckman, my producer, as I call her, Erin Brockovich, around the office because she's pretty brassy and pretty tough.
Yeah.
She did some reaching out, and Gail came up with a diver that we have been working with. And this diver, you know, I met him in the spring. This process, by the way, has been going on since February, you know, and I think you realize it takes a lot of time to put some of this stuff together and to make some of this stuff happen, you know. And
yeah,
so
it doesn't happen overnight. No.
You don't just throw a diver in the water, you know, and say, here's a metal detector, go cover this area and go find it, you
right.
know. So what happened was I began to learn more and more about this very complicated process of what was going to have to happen. So I met with our forensic dive leader, and this is a guy who does this for a living. He recovers bodies. He recovers weapons. He's just a hell of a guy, and he's got stories for days, and he dives deep water shipwrecks and what have you. So he said when I met him in Amityville, he said, you know, the very first thing that's got to happen if you're serious about finding this, okay, is we need to call in a survey company, and I know one that's very, very, very well equipped to do this job, and they have a sled that they tow across the bottom, okay? And this sled is two things. There's two prongs to it. It's an electromagnetic device, okay, and it can go anywhere between 6 and 15 feet deep in the mud, okay, to find a metallic object, and it'll register a metallic hit. Now, when it registers a metallic hit, this company has military-grade GPS, and so it registers the hit, and then it fixes it on a GPS map. So I've got these, literally, Brian, I've got these huge color rolls, okay, of everything on the canal floor that was located. They found 317 metallic objects on the floor of the canal. And then what they do is after they've towed the sled and after they've done this elaborate survey and they've got it done, then they process the info through a computer. And the computer will take the profile of the metal object and it can literally almost determine, like, this piece is aluminum. Okay, so this is most likely not going to be a gun. Okay, this piece over here is stainless steel or this is wrought iron or whatever, you know. And so once they put those numbers through the computer and all that info, then the computer helps them eliminate the object that they're looking for based on the density and its size and all of those kinds of things. And so they came back, excuse me, they came back with roughly right at about 100 targets, okay, that had to be looked at. And that was what we were doing at the canal.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I think, you know, if you saw the photo, you probably saw the photo.
The video, yeah.
The Suffolk police was obviously involved in this, you know. And this took the cooperation of more than a few departments to pull this effort together and to make it happen, you know. And the cool part about doing a survey like this is that, as Bill explained to me when we first met, is he said, I can guarantee you that if we do this electromagnetic survey, which costs, by the way, tens of thousands of dollars to get done, you know, if we do the survey, we're going to be able to determine two things. Okay, either we will come out, if there is a gun in the canal, we will come out with the gun in our hand. Okay, and if there is not a gun in the canal, okay, we will be able to determine beyond a shadow of the doubt that it's not there. So in deciding and making the decision to do this and to go forward with this endeavor, you know, that really appealed to me, because there was kind of a sense of closure or a sense of finality to the thesis. We are either going to prove ourselves right or we are going to prove ourselves wrong. Okay, but either way, we know beyond a shadow of the doubt.
Either way, exactly. And if there's been something there, it's been there for 30 some years. Currents and that moved it.
The very first thing that had to be done before you could do a survey of anything, was the very first thing that had to be done was we had to send divers into the water to map the area, okay? And in the course of going in and mapping the area, what they did was they took measuring sticks with them, and they were able to get a measurement of silt and then the mud, okay? And you have to understand, in a water body like this, there's not a lot of movement, because this is basically a man-made canal. You know, it's a tributary going out to the Great South Bay that runs parallel with Ocean Avenue. Of course, we know that the DeFeo House backed up to this canal, to the bulkhead. And so there's not a lot of movement. There's not a lot of current that really shifts things around. So the water stays relatively still, you know. And so they were able to go out, and the first thing that they did was they mapped the silt. Now, silt is just dust and debris, and, you know, you understand if a leaf blows into the water and it lands on the canal floor, that will decompose and it will become silt, okay? And as the silt sits there and piles up, the silt becomes mud, okay? And this mud on the canal floor is this it's a very aerobic, very nasty, disgusting mud. I mean, to just pull something out of the water and smell the mud, it literally makes you want to vomit.
It's not that bad. Yeah.
Because there is a huge lack of oxygen in this mud. Okay, so the very first thing our divers did was they went out, they basically identified the target area. We said this is how far out we think this gun could have possibly been thrown. Okay, we know that it's going to be in this general area. And what we did was we then mapped that whole area and got the silt measurements, which ranged between 6 inches and, let's say, 18 inches at the extreme. So you knew you had between 6 and 18 inches of just silt on the bottom before you hit mud, okay? And in some cases, we had mud that was between, you know, 4 to maybe 6 feet deep, and in some cases even deeper than that. You know, there was at one point one of our divers had, I think he had a 4-foot measuring stick in the mud, and he had that in his hand, and he then had his arm clear up to his shoulder in the mud, and he still hadn't hit anything solid at the bottom to indicate that he was at the gravel that's normally associated with the bottom of the canal.
Jeez.
You know, so we knew we had a lot, we had to look for... We had to look for a needle in a haystack is what it amounted to.
Yeah, pretty.
You know?
Huh.
And the thing with the gun is this was a handgun, you realize. So it's not a big gun. It didn't weigh a tremendous amount, you know, maybe 3 or 4 pounds, you know. And when that gun went into the water, it would have landed in the silt, okay? And it would have gone right through the silt very quickly, and it would have hit the mud. And the gun then went down into the mud, okay, and basically sat there, you know, and we're talking about mud that is lacking oxygen, Okay, so therefore, anything that goes into that mud is going to be very, very, very well preserved after even 37 years. You know, so this was a very, I thought, frankly, I thought it was one of the most fun elements of doing this film, because it really was, you know, we took, you know, 40-year-old documents, and we examined the material in them, and we examined and listened to the testimony of what people told us while we were making this film pertaining to this gun, you know, and we weighed, you know, Butch DeFeo's story and his account of Bobby Kelski, and we weighed Kelski's witness statements, and we took all of this historical research, and then we brought the science in behind it. You know, we brought the survey company that's got these really badass toys that they that are great to play with. Okay. You know, this company, by the way, works. They work a lot of times for the government, for the federal government, and they've also worked for various governments around the world. They were involved in the mapping of the lost city of Alexandria for the government of Egypt. I know the owner of the company just came back from Laos. They've been over there mapping. I believe he said that there's like 80,000 unexploded bombs in the jungle in Laos, okay, as a result of the Vietnam War. And so they're over there mapping those bombs and trying to recover that stuff. They do very deep water stuff, so this was a very different type of project for them, because we were dealing with a maximum depth at most, in most cases, of like 8 to 9 feet, you know. And so we brought in the science, and we did this survey, we did this very complicated survey, and then we went back, and the survey company is able to guide our divers in the water within approximately 2 inches of the target that they've mapped. So there's very precise, an element of very accurate, very precise mapping and digging going on here. And it's really quite entertaining to watch, and it's going to make a terrific segment in the film, you know. And I would like to say what our conclusions are and what was, you know, there, but, you know, it's like, you know how it is. Until this thing comes out.
Yeah, yeah.
Mum's the word.
Yeah. So, what else did they find? You said there were like hundreds of stuff. There was hundreds of things down there. What did they? I mean,
well,
they make
you know, you're like, talking about talking about a waterway that's you know well over probably 100-150 years old. I don't know when that canal was dug precisely, but you know, we would hit things. Well, the very first dig, the thing that I grinned about that made me really happy was that, you know, they dug the first target, and they literally pulled a piece of metal, a piece of pipe, out of the bottom about 3 feet deep in the mud. They pulled this piece of pipe out that was bent at a 90-degree angle. In other words, it was shaped identical to what a handgun would be, okay? So we knew, just based on that first dig, we knew that the electromagnetic survey had really done its job, and they had really delineated the targets very well. And obviously, that's a good thing, because we don't want to have to dig 317 targets, you
right.
know. And
there's nothing.
And so
but
there was metal.
There was nothing.
There was nothing but
guns.
Long, skinny brackets that looked like they had come off of a boat. You know, there was the occasional beer can. And a lot of times we found a lot of beer cans and a lot of you know, litter like that just in the course of digging an actual target area.
There was nothing but guns in this canal. That's all we found were guns.
Well, that was my big concern. Was I was afraid that they were going to come out of the canal with 10 guns, and then I was going to be like, oh, crap, you know.
Yeah.
and it didn't happen. So we got lucky there. But there was just a lot of random, you know, we actually found what was once a power drill at one point. Obviously, there again, sort of shaped like a gun. So we had a lot of luck. We had a lot of, you know, we had a lot of junk that we pulled out of there.
Yeah, you could use that power drill. It's probably still good. You just need to dry it out.
dry it out a little bit and, and take it back to Sears. And and I think if it's a Craftsman, I think they'll give you a new one, I think.
Why not? Well, that
so, you know, this has been a very intense part of the project. I am very pleased that we did this. You know, I am very happy with the outcome. I'm very pleased that we did take the time to explore this. It was well worth, you know, the 7-8 months worth of planning and coordination that it took. You know, there were, at one point, there was as many, I believe, as I think we had like seven to nine divers in the water at one point. You know, of course, we've got boats and we've got these electromagnetic sleds out there, and we've got, it was really kind of a circus, but a lot of fun, a lot of fun.
What kind of attention did you draw to it? I mean, were the people, the residents, were they checking it out? What are they doing over there?
You would actually be surprised. Okay. Not really. Not really. You know, we encountered some very nice people who came, you know, and talked to us while we were doing this, and, you know, and they were very interested in what we were doing, and we were very direct and very honest about what we were doing. You know, we had decided that we were just going to be completely forthright with everybody about what our thesis was and what was going on, you know, And it was a very positive experience in terms of that. But no, we probably didn't talk to more than 3 or 4 people, you know, over the course of a number of days that this has taken place, you know. So and as I said, everybody was very, very pleasant, and everybody. Amityville is just such a charming, beautiful little South Shore community, and you know, I think that Amityville is ready for. I think they're ready for our film. I think that they will probably be somewhat appreciative when it's done, I hope, when the truth of the crime comes out, when you begin to break it down and understand what really happened there, that there's no ghosts, there's no demons, there's no demonic possession taking place at 112 Ocean Avenue or 108 or whatever the hell the address is these days. You know, and you know, I really do think that they will get behind a project that is I loved your terminology when you reviewed it. You called the film honest, you know, and I hope that they find the film as honest as what you did in the review.
I noticed a quote up on the AmityvilleFilm.com website, too. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, we put you and Maria Arkel from...
Creepshow Radio?
From Creepshow Radio. You two are the only two so far to have reviewed it. You guys really got the sneak peek. There's going to be some more reviews going out, some more screener copies, I guess I should say, probably in the next 2 to 3 weeks as we get closer to that December 16th date. And there's just a lot going on right now, and we're really... we're really being inundated with emails wanting to know where can we get this, when can we, you know, when is it coming out. We haven't announced the date at all until tonight. You know, I haven't told anybody that we're planning on December 16th. And one of the other things that we're juggling right now, which is taking a lot of time, is, you know, we, of course, got the edit locked, and then we went through mastering, and we've done color correction. And in all honesty, I'm really still fussing with the film myself. I think I probably said this last time, you know, I'm going to look back on this film 5 years from now, and I'm going to say, why didn't I do that? Why did I leave that way? Why didn't I take this opportunity to do this? You know, I think that as the artist, I think you're always nitpicking yourself. And I finally just got to the point where I said, okay, the edit is locked. The film is good. It's perfect. Don't touch it. But now I can't resist going back and just doing little tweaks here and there to, you know, the color, or to add a filter where I think it needs to be added. Or, you know, there's a little tiny pop right there in the audio. We need to get rid of that, you know. And I'm literally just kind of, you know, fussing over this thing and really finessing it and trying to get just the prettiest, cleanest, best-sounding copy that I can possibly deliver.
You sound like every director I have ever known.
Well, like, you know, you want it to be people have been waiting for a long time for this.
You want it to be perfect.
And I do not want them to be disappointed.
Yeah, yeah. It's got to be perfect. Yeah, every director I know, it's like they're perfectionists.
Well, and you're always, as the artist, you're always harder on yourself probably than what anybody else, you know, will be.
Oh yeah. And when I go back listen to the show, though, I just complain about my, you know, my interviews or whatever. I should have said this. I should have said that. The audio,
yeah, absolutely.
Audio
absolutely.
Should have been a little louder.
It's part of the process. You know, Margot Kidder, in a documentary on the making of the Amityville Horror, you know, that was on a box set 4 or 5 years ago, Margot Kidder, I think it was, I'm sure it was Margot Kidder, said, you know, that she never watches any of her films, you know, after they come out, because she says, all I see are the missed opportunities. You know, and so I think when this comes out, I don't think I'll ever watch it again. I don't want to see my missed opportunities. Yeah, I would rather just let it be. Okay, there it is. It's out. You know, enjoy it. Don't enjoy it. Whatever. You know, but it's done. You know, and I feel, but I really do feel, Brian, very, very good about the film. I think that it's really going to deliver. You know, you saw a draft that is about 3 drafts old now, you know, in terms of polish and all that. And I can only tell you that I think that when you see the final product, it's going to be a huge change from what you reviewed. I mean, not in content, not in anything that you saw, just in its flow. You know, we went through and there was some repetition, you know, where an interviewee said something and then the narrator said the same thing. It was like, we can get rid of one of those two. You know, or where I let somebody make their point and then keep talking. You know, there were more than a few of those little clips where it was like, you know, I like what so-and-so says in that clip, but I can lose that extra 15 seconds. I don't need it. You know, and when you do that and you make those cuts, all of a sudden the pacing and the flow just picks way up, and it really does at this point have, I think, a really nice flow to it.
Well, there was a lot. I mean, there is a lot of information packed in 2 hours. Man.
Yeah, there is. And the thing about part two, which I'm really excited to get part two out next, you know, part two is, I guess the best word I could use is kind of dizzying, almost compared to part one. Because, you know, part one, and I think we talked about this, you know, part one is really, of the 3 parts that we filmed, of the three almost separate films that we made on this subject, you know, part one is the slowest moving one, and I'm not knocking it, I'm not saying it's a slow moving piece, but it takes a lot of time to get the backstories, the players, the locations, the people, to get everybody on the table. So that when you do slip into part two, you've already got all the background. You know everything that led up to these events. And so therefore, when part two, I felt like when I started editing and I started cutting together two, it was almost kind of liberating because it was like, all of that's done. I don't have to explain anything. We're in the present day moment of the murders now, so let's just run with it. Let's just put this together, and you go from hearing about what happened all these years ago to now it's almost kind of like you're there.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
This whole thing is playing out in real time, and I think part two is really going to bowl people over, I hope.
Yeah, end of the scene where at the cliffhanger, where
yes.
Where the transition from that gritty film,
mm-hmm.
is that one moment where the can I say it? The shadow
yes.
figure,
yes,
hands
yes.
him, and he goes, pew, 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 and all of a sudden it's in real time, you know.
Right,
it looks
right,
like a real time.
Right.
That was clever.
And you're obviously we have the foresight. You know, we know what happened. You know, and we know what's coming. And so, part two, I'm not going to give anything about part two away, but when part two comes in, you just, your head is kind of spinning after the first few minutes because, you know, of where I elect to start the story and how I elect to kind of track a little bit backwards, and we kind of move around through part two, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun for the people sitting at home watching.
Yeah. So you're going to be doing a show with, you're on, you got an upcoming interview Monday morning with Mark and Brian?
Mark and Brian, yeah. And in fact, I have two shows on Monday. We have Mark and Brian at 9 a.m., which I'm told that it's going to be between 10 and 20 minutes. Have no idea what to expect there. And then I guess it'll all be based on whether they think I'm interesting or not. So it'll probably be a pretty short interview. Yeah. But we have that at 9, and that's based out of 95.5 KLOS out of Los Angeles. So if anybody out there wants to tune in, I think I am assuming it's a streaming show that you can listen to live. And then at 9:30, we're in the studio with Actors E, and we're going to be doing a live webcast with them. And Actors E is this great little, they're kind of a trade website for actors and directors and people along those lines. And they get together and they chat. They have this great little hour-long format where you go on and you talk about whatever projects you're working on, and then they kind of pan to the photographs and, you know, headshots and moving clips, and they're actually going to feature a few clips of the film, you know, in the in this particular webcast. So it's going to be another really great show. I've done the show once before and loosely talked about Amityville, but I think this time is going to be mainly Amityville and mainly talking about the release. And I'm going to be joined by Diana Maiocco, who plays Louise DeFeo in the film. And Diana is also my partner on this project and has been here from day one. And you know, we've been down a very long road together. And so it'll be nice to have her accompany, you know, on this show as well.
Oh, great. Well, I wonder what it's like, that little town, Amityville, they've got to hate Halloween. This has got to be the worst.
Actually, it's really funny. When I was there, you know, last week, they were completely, Ocean Avenue, they go all out on Ocean Avenue. It is, some of those houses, I mean, they've got entire, you know, graveyards in their front yard, you know, and they go all out in their decorations. It's really pretty cool because I've been there now like 2 years in a row right around Halloween both times, and they really love Halloween.
Do they?
And it's really kind of surprising because I'm like you. I would think that, you know, they would just cringe when this time of year comes around and be like, oh God, you know, here comes the weirdos, you know, but not the case at all.
I wonder what kind of candy they give out at the Amityville house. Trick or treat. She give out those big Hershey bars, a big bar, you know, here, kid.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, I don't know if they give, they might give bacon.
Bacon.
In honor of Jody.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Here's a Ziploc of bacon. Here you go.
Yeah, here's a slice of bacon, kid. Enjoy it. You know, we just cooked this up out back.
Yeah. Well, Ryan, it was good having you on again. Well, you know, keep updated. The movie's coming out, part one is coming out December 16th.
December 16th on DVD.
Available at, what is it, AmityvilleFilm.com? You've got a new it's
well,
Shattered
we're AmityvilleFilm.com and we're also ShatteredDocumentary.com. We have both you know, domains. They're both ours. I use Shattered Documentary for another reason that involves this. Anyway, I'm not going to get into it. But AmityvilleFilm.com or ShatteredDocumentary.com, either one. Part one is going to be available exclusively on our website for probably about the first 60 days. Our plan, what we're planning to do is, once part two comes out, then we will relegate part one off to, you know, Amazon or Best Buy or wherever. You'll be able to buy it in a number of different places. And part two will then be exclusively available on our website. And then the same thing will happen when part three comes out. Then we will make part two available in other outlets.
Okay, Ryan. Have yourself a great Halloween. Thanks for coming
on. You do the same, Brian. You do the same. And as always, it's been great. And thanks for having us on.
Yeah, well, it's even next year when the movie's done, I still got to have you on because it's tradition.
It's tradition. Well, I could possibly maybe have some more news about another project sort of like this that I could be working on by that time.
Okay, great. Great. And and actually, I still have a DVD that you sent me. I got to make sure that I get that back to you.
Oh, that would be the Judge Nam documentary.
Yeah, I still have it.
Whatever, no big deal.
Okay, all right.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Hey, we'll talk to you soon, Brian.
Yeah,
thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, Ryan Katzenbach. The release date is December 16th, just in time for Christmas. Be a great stocking stuffer for some of you. You guys all have a great Halloween weekend. I know there's a lot of parties out there. Might hit one tomorrow. Costume party. I just go as myself. All right. Anyway. All right. I'm headed out. You guys, we're going to get the replay. It's going to be up shortly. This broadcast will be made into a podcast. So, just stay streaming in for now and talk to you on the flip.
Through the streets of Soho in the rain, he was looking for the place called Lee Ho Fooks. Gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein. Werewolves of London. Kitchen door. You better not let him in. Little old lady got mutilated late last night. Werewolves of London again. Werewolves of London. Hairy-handed gent who ran amok in Kent. Lately he's been overheard in Mayfair. You better stay away from him. He'll rip your lungs out, Jim. I'd like to meet his tailor. Werewolves of London. I saw Lon Chaney walking with the Queen, doing the werewolves of London. I saw Lon Chaney Jr. walking with the Queen, doing the werewolves of London. I saw a werewolf drinking a pina colada at Trader Vic's. His hair was perfect.